Hello, and welcome to episode 107 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Darian Unger, professor at Howard University School of Business, an environmental engineer, and Montgomery County firefighter and emergency medical technician, co-chair of Progressive Neighbors, and the co-chair of the Montgomery County American Civil Liberties Union. He's also a former candidate for delegate in Montgomery County's District 20. Darian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
Excellent. So the first question I'd like to pose to you is, what are you currently doing, or what have you ever done to advance the public interest, and why?
that's quite a lot, is what I'm doing or have ever done. I mean, the most basic things that I do are my work in my family, right? I'm raising three kids. I work at Howard University, where we concentrate on innovation, and my particular interest is the innovation of environmental energy technologies and entrepreneurship with our mostly minority students, mm-hmm. having them start companies. And my work in fire rescue, responding to 911 calls in Silver Spring and Tacoma Park.
So that's an interesting combination. How are you? Are you able? Are you a part-time volunteer firefighter?
Well, I do my regular shifts are mm-hmm. I usually do 12 hours on Thursday nights. I was on last Thursday night. I'll be back on Thursday night from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m.
every week. 12
I used to
hours.
Do this more often, but I actually, with three kids, that's my most regular shift.
That's amazing. So you're a volunteer firefighter, 12 hours every week.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, the shifts can change around.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, it's. I've been doing that since I was. I started as a firefighter. I started training when I was 18.
Wow, and so you've kept it up your whole life.
Well, there were 4 years when I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Or 2 years when I was in Florida, I was a volunteer EMT only for the American Red Cross because they had no volunteer fire structure. But I was I did in Pennsylvania and Florida and here.
What attracts you to being a firefighter? Why is it you do that, especially given all your other responsibilities and your family?
Well, I think it's one of the most. I mean, it's very gratifying work. I really enjoy it. I started training when I was 18, and I was at Swarthmore College. And I think just about everybody there does some form of community service. And I think there was a kind of an activities fair in the beginning for, you know, 18-year-old freshmen, and mm-hmm. and there, you know, you can do all sorts. There are all sorts of ways to improve the world. You could work in soup kitchens, or you could work on environmental groups, or you mm-hmm. could tutor kids in Chester, Pennsylvania, and then there was all that, and then down the street, completely separate from that, there was a sign in front of the firehouse that they needed firefighters, and I thought, well, that would be a little different. And it's not something that I dreamed of doing. It's not like I even played with fire engines as a kid, but uh-huh. it struck me as a very exciting way to try to help people. And so I started that training while I was in college.
Do you have any crazy stories?
I think probably anybody in fire rescue has crazy stories. I mean, that was back in 1991.
Yeah.
So sure. I mean, there are plenty of there. I mean, that's many 911 calls that we've responded to.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very different from the rest of my work. I mean, my work at Howard University, mm-hmm. for example, is much. It's much longer term, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm working with a student for a semester or a year, or mm-hmm. a graduate student for years, mm-hmm. Trying to help my students and former students. Start businesses or get funding for their companies or break into, you know, into larger companies so that they can climb their ladder.
Mm-hmm.
And I do my research on innovation, and but that's much longer term work.
Talk right? more about and the then, research then, on innovation.
Well, so I'm particularly interested in the development of environmental energy technologies. Mm-hmm. So fuel cells, energy efficient light bulbs, like you know, LEDs and OLEDs, the next generation OLEDs.
What does that stand
organic
for?
LEDs. Organic light emitting diodes is what OLED stands for.
Uh-huh.
And hybrids, electric cars. It used to just be the design as an environmental engineer, but it turns out that a lot of it now is not just the design, but how we get people to adopt environmental energy technologies.
So some of the technologies exist in the market, but people are still using the less environmentally friendly technology.
That's right. And it actually goes back to, for example, I mean, there are lots of examples. They go back to, for example, Edison.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So when Edison invented, so to speak, the light bulb, he didn't actually invent it. He made it better from earlier versions, but he gets a lot of credit for it. It's a really fun story. I mean, this is a guy who essentially invented the light bulb and the electric industry,
mm-hmm.
and he kept a 40-watt light bulb on his desk. If you've been to Menlo Park, then you've kind of seen what it looks like. But he never sold them, right? What he sold were things like 12-watt bulbs, and the reason why was because that's what people were used to. People were used to candlelight or gas lamps. Right.
So he created a 40-watt, but yeah. He sold a 12-watt, which was perfect. Less powerful,
right.
Because it was...
Because that's what people would adopt, right?
Huh.
That's what the market would adopt,
huh.
Right? And so there's a long history in innovation and market adoption of people not being quite comfortable with the new technology. I mean, you get the techies,
yeah.
Right? And technophiles, people who really want the latest, greatest thing. And we get
mm-hmm.
that a little bit with phones and,
mm-hmm.
and apps. But you also get people who are used to the old thing.
Mm-hmm.
We saw the same thing with, for example, with compact fluorescent bulbs, right? Or even some of the LEDs
mm-hmm.
that people the color's off, right? People don't like the color of it. It's a little too white, right? They're used to the yellow of
mm-hmm.
the old incandescents.
Right.
There's no particular reason for it, except that psychologically we've been built up for that for decades.
Right.
And so. A lot of, in order to break in a new environmental technology, it has to mimic the old technology in some way.
Like a Kindle, where the screen is intentionally made to look like a paper book.
Exactly, right? So, or you've turned the pages and it looks like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason for that at all, except for the psychology of the market,
uh-huh.
right? But if that's what makes people feel comfortable, then that's sometimes what you need to do in order to introduce a new technology. And then later on, it will often change.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of interesting work to be done in this area. And so, if we want people to adopt, for example, environmental energy technologies or cars or light bulbs, the trick is how we can do it when we know that when they're first introduced, they'll be more expensive than their rivals.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And some people can do it. Like let's say you want to buy a new light bulb. A brand new LED will cost more than 10 times an old light bulb.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone living on a paycheck might not be able to afford the initial high capital investment.
Right.
And that's, so how do you solve that problem? You could just sell it to richer folks, richer, greener folks, right, who care about this and have the money to spend.
Well, only 100.
And hope that,
yeah.
You know, economies of scale eventually force the price down.
Mm-hmm.
But there are you can also change the business model,
mm-hmm.
right? You can, when some companies wanted to introduce this, they tried to introduce it in light bulbs that are kind of hard to change, like streetlights
mm-hmm.
or traffic lights,
mm-hmm.
right? Because those are, they need to not go out often.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of expensive to change.
Mm-hmm.
You need a cherry picker, you need a crew. And so cities were a little more receptive to that idea,
mm-hmm.
right, than individual consumers. So you started with an incubator market.
Interesting.
Of municipalities, right? And that's a way to break in an environmental technology.
And they have a steady revenue stream that isn't necessarily living paycheck to paycheck. They have an entire...
That's right. Although there is a different problem there, which is that a mayor of... Take a mayor of whatever generic city you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're talking about saving... You know that in the long run, it saves energy and it saves money.
Right.
Because a long-term, low wattage light bulb that acts just like an old incandescent doesn't need to be changed for say 20 years, uses 1/12 of the electricity, but you're still paying a lot of money up front. So
mm-hmm.
does a mayor who's there for 4 years really care enough to blow out the city budget in the short term in order for some long-term gain?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not. So in some ways, they will think in the same way as someone living paycheck to paycheck. They can't afford to think about the long term. So how do you overcome that problem? Well, one way, for example, is you turn a business model on its head and you essentially give it out for free. You say, all right, we'll give you these light bulbs for free. You pay us back in the energy savings over time, right? Profitable for the company, but now you've turned this into a finance problem, right? So
how do you find the original capital with in the private sector
right.
that would be willing to take the long-term returns? But isn't that what they do with mortgage trading?
Yeah, I mean, this is entirely doable. It's not like this is... It's not... Well, actually, it is pretty complicated, but it's not rocket science.
Right.
And but it hadn't really been done in environmental energy technologies until it was tried there. So, I mean, there are all sorts of ideas, systems, and areas of study to be able to better introduce environmental energy technologies from, and they can range from changing models in lights to solar panels. So that's an area that I really like to do my work, research, and teaching in as well. Hmm. And I've got a bunch of terrific students who are full of good ideas, are smart, and are incredibly ambitious and active in this field. So it's terrific to help them start and help them learn how to do a business model and try to attract investment and put together the project planning to be able to make it possible.
So have you been able... Now, you also ran for office,
mm-hmm.
and you mentioned that there are some political realities that often prevent new technologies from being adopted across society. Is that something that influenced your decision to run for office?
Well, I think that my interest in science and innovation is helpful... would be helpful in office.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's, I think that especially now in the Trump era, evidence-based policy would be a good thing. this seems to be a time when truth and facts seem to be optional for some people,
mm-hmm.
And it isn't. They aren't, and it should not be that way. But I think scientific literacy is particularly important.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, especially, I think that to be able to make credible policy proposals on the environmental front requires the ability to discern on a scientific level, and the ability to take a kind of engineering or scientific problem solving approach.
Interesting.
And I think that would be helpful.
So is that something that you try to impart to your students, an evidence-based approach to, or is that something that's not even very much, that's innately a part of engineering?
Well, I mean, I actually teach in the business, I'm an environmental engineer, but I teach in the business school. I'm teaching neither science nor policy, although I certainly come with that background.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm not necessarily teaching evidence-based policy or science.
Yeah.
But if you're introducing a new technology, it's helpful to be able to talk about the basics and be able to translate from scientific jargon to something more useful that consumers would be interested in, so people understand why something is better.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the case of fossil fuels or fracking, why something is dangerous,
mm-hmm.
Or to investors, why this idea is such a good idea. And you want to be able to explain it both on a, perhaps on a policy level, but also in terms of investment and adoption and practical applicability.
Sounds like messaging is really a key part of having a successful business. You speak about innovation with your students and just in technological innovation in general in the last century or two, and how certain innovations are introduced to the market, but the market may not be ready.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to adopt the product and the messaging in order to increase adoption. Innovation without adoption is not very useful to anyone. So can you talk for a minute about how you teach your students about the importance of messaging to your audience in order to become a successful entrepreneur?
Well, it's certainly a lot of what... It's part of entrepreneurship, right? Part of entrepreneurship is being able to not just invent, right? Not just invent a better mousetrap, but be able to show why it's better, to be able to convince people, because invention alone doesn't do it. Well, then it's just invention. It's not really innovation.
Huh.
Right?
What's the difference between invention and innovation?
Well, innovation is much broader, right? I mean, invention is literally just simply invention. Right?
Creating something new.
Yes.
What if I were to...
Innovation to me is broader and can incorporate many aspects of market adoption and it takes so much more into account.
If I take a jacket that has buttons and I put a zipper on that jacket? Have I innovated the way jackets are designed and invented a zipper?
Well, okay, so that's a particularly interesting example, because zipper itself, is that actually was an invention at first, and it was actually a patented, copyrighted thing.
So the zipper is the invention, but the application of the zipper is the innovation.
Yeah, the innovation combines them.
Yeah.
But interestingly, you just happened to pick zipper, but zipper was actually a copyrighted term. It was actually, was a comb fastener. And in the same way that some people will now sometimes say, hey, can you Xerox this for me?
Right? Or offer me a Kleenex.
Right? That is, those are actually trade names.
Yeah.
Right? And Kleenex and Xerox will, they'll take you to court over it, right? They know that if it ever becomes the actual word for the product, they'll lose their trademark, right? So it's Kleenex brand facial tissues, I believe, or something like that. And Xerox copiers, or now more appropriately, document centers. And so they will actually fight that because exactly of the example of zipper, which was a company, and now it's no longer a company because it's a generic word.
So
you can lose your copyrights and trademarks that way.
Interesting. So pivoting a little bit back to other areas of public service, because you're involved in so much. Why are you involved in, you said you're the co-chair of Progressive Neighbors and of the ACLU's chapter in Montgomery County. Why are you involved in those activities?
I think these are important. They take on really important issues that we need in order to make the world a better place.
Sure.
One concentrates on civil rights and civil liberties, which are under extraordinary threat right now, especially under the Trump administration. Although we actually had concerns under the Obama administration about civil liberties and
like with the NSA and mass data surveillance.
Exactly. I mean, so it's and some of those actually expanded under the Obama administration as well. So that's nonpartisan, right? And we find that both liberals and conservatives may have deep reservations about the government tapping your phone, for example.
Right.
Or any other form of communication. And when warrants are needed, and when you can be tracked, and that sort of thing happens here in Montgomery County as well. So we tackle everything from that to criminal justice reform, which is again more important than ever. I think that more people are aware of it a little more now because there are more cameras out there, and so I think miscarriages of justice can hit the web a lot faster, and people can see things with their own eyes, whereas when perhaps earlier millions of people just simply didn't know that sort of thing happened. And so there is significant movement for criminal justice reform of several different types. And then some of those criminal justice reform questions involve separate questions about how do you make sure that the justice system applies itself fairly to people across racial and economic spectra, or help to solve a problem, say if one part of police accountability involves cameras, that's fine, but then who gets to see that footage? Do the police get to see it first?
And what makes you well qualified to be involved with the ACLU? What makes it your role? I guess it sounds like there are a lot of different threats to ACLU, but why are you involved in particular?
Well, I think that I've mainly through longevity alone. Right, I'm not an attorney, but many people in the ACLU are not attorneys themselves. But I think that I was particularly aware of issues of civil liberties, civil rights, freedom of religion, just by being. I think that being in a minority of almost any kind. As a kid, can probably help increase sensitivity about certain issues, right? And make you realize.
Were you a member of a minority as a kid?
I was Jewish in a neighborhood that was not.
Where did you grow up?
This was near Philadelphia.
Okay.
And And so I think that when you are a member of a group that is not a majority, mm-hmm. you become much more aware, probably earlier on, about what that can mean and the importance of minority rights in a variety of different situations.
Did that lead to any extent to your current position at a historically African-American college?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that I would not... I mean, I really wanted to teach at Howard University because it has a mission that I really believe in.
What's that mission?
Well, there are several, but the story to it is an interesting one for me. I was at MIT, mm-hmm. and then my wife to be and I went abroad for a while, and I was teaching. We wanted to go abroad, and I
where'd you go?
I got a job as visiting faculty at the Asian Institute of Technology in Thailand, in Bangkok. And that was a fascinating experience for me. And it was, and at one point, it was a life-changing experience teaching there. I was teaching graduate students, and I wasn't sure that I wanted to be a professor. I thought that I would get back into the energy industry, having worked in it before, having gone to graduate school. I thought I would go back, but I wanted to try out my teaching legs. Because it turns out that I quite enjoyed TAing, being a teaching assistant at MIT. Plus, I was getting quite serious about marrying a teacher to be. And I was trying to teach the equivalent of something that I had taught before at MIT, mm-hmm. at AIT, at the Asian Institute of Technology. And part of it actually relates back to this question that we were just talking about with light bulbs. I was teaching a class about large-scale energy projects. There, a large-scale energy project could be a hydroelectric dam, mm-hmm. right? Requires, hundreds of millions or $1 billion of investment, but once you do, you have free energy, so to speak. I mean, you're not paying for fuel. And I had a student who raised his hand, and asked early on in the class about whether or not. Just for background, I was explaining that like getting an energy efficient light bulb, you have to pay more up mm-hmm. front, mm-hmm. but it reaps benefits in the long run, mm-hmm. and it's a major finance question, but it's the similar issue to what people face when they buy light bulbs. And a student raised his hand, and he was my one Cambodian student, and given the history of Cambodia, any student in graduate school. Mm-hmm. Probably has a story because anybody who could read was killed during the war and genocide that occurred there.
The Khmer Rouge,
exactly. And so they killed doctors, teachers, anybody who could read, people who wore glasses, people who could speak other languages. So the fact that this kid, he was in his 20s, right? But what was in graduate school in another country because there was no graduate school in Cambodia. Pretty much said. I mean, it took a village to put him there.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you could tell he represented a lot. And he raised his hand, and his scarred arm, his arm had scars all over it. And I don't, mm-hmm. It's scary to think what this guy went through, or his family went through in the killing fields. And he raised his hand and asked a very polite version of the question. So, how does this work if your country is in a civil war? Right, this financing stuff and financing energy projects, and I looked at him I thought for a second and I said, I don't know. Let me get back to you on this. I don't have a good answer for you on this. Let me get back to you on this. And I came home and basically did the electronic equivalent of tearing up my notes, and I said to Jill, I think I have to start this class from scratch. You can't just. I mean, my students were sharp as anything, uh-huh. right? But you can't just take a class from MIT and transfer it over and expect everything to be the same because it was just a different situation. It wasn't a question of ability; it was just a question of a different situation. And I really came to appreciate how much I learned from differences, from my students as well. Mm-hmm. So when we decided we were going to come back to the U.S., mm-hmm. We were deciding on what city we could both happily live in. Mm-hmm. There were precious few. But one of them, Washington, D.C., or the area around it, was one of them. And I said, this was 10,000 miles away. I said, if we're there, I think I'd really like to teach at Howard University. I mean, I think that its mission has value in a way that I think is lacking in a lot of business schools. Mm-hmm. I mean, at Howard, it's about getting a seat at the table and forwarding equality and creating a more level playing field. Mm-hmm. And it's a different sort of business school. And so I really enjoy, and by luck, there happened to be an opening at Howard University in exactly my field at the time we were coming back to the United States.
Huh.
And interviewed, got a job offer, and have been there ever since. I got tenure after 7 years.
Are there many white Jewish professors at Howard University?
No. No.
Are there many white Jewish students at Howard University?
No. But
is it unusual, or do you feel differently, or do the students react to you differently than perhaps they might to another faculty member?
Well, I don't know. I think you'd have to ask the students that. But, I mean, I've felt very welcome throughout. I mean, sometimes students will ask about my background or why I'm there.
Yeah.
Usually the younger students ask that. Uh-huh. Older students either are too jaded or are under the impression that that's no longer a polite question to ask. but if I ever teach a freshman class, my freshman usually have no qualms about asking that question.
How do you respond?
Oh, it depends. It depends
same on kind how, of story you've
it,
been telling
them? Well, perhaps. I mean, it depends on how long, on how much they were asking that question and how long we have I have to answer it. But there are a lot of reasons, and I really enjoy it there.
Hmm.
I love the students. I love what I'm able to teach to them and what they're able to do afterwards.
Now, as we approach the end of this podcast, I'd like to ask you a final question. I mean, you're a white, you're a professor teaching at a historically black college. You are an environmental engineer, but also a firefighter. You're an EMT on Thursday nights. You are involved in incredibly local stuff with Progressive Neighbors. You're not an attorney, but you're involved with the ACLU of Montgomery County. You've run for elected office. You've taught students about large energy projects on the other side of the world in Southeast Asia. What is it that ties us all together? Why? What is the common thread? Why are you interested in public service? How have you found yourself doing so many different things all at the same time? And why have you engaged in so many different things? What is it really that drives you? What's the common thread there?
Well, I think, to me, those actually aren't that diverse. I mean, I can tell you the common thread. I think that many people, at least I hope that many people, really do want to try to improve the world in some way, right? You want to leave the world better when you leave it than when you find it. And for me, that involves a couple of big things. One is making the world a fairer place. And that manifests itself in a lot of different ways, but progressive policies that allow equal opportunity are a big part of it, because I think that we live in a manifestly unfair world, and I think that there are a lot of ways to improve it, whether through education, civil rights, equal opportunity for everybody, regardless of their background and who they are. And then the second very important part for me is making sure that the world continues to exist. And as an environmental engineer, I have been taking global warming seriously for decades at this point, and was working on the models at the Energy Lab at MIT, and know and recognize its threat. Mm-hmm. And so I want a fairer world, and I want a world that will continue to exist more or less in the way that we know it for generations to come. And unless we do something much more dramatic on the environmental front to increase adoption of renewable energy technologies, we are going to have irreparable global warming. So those two things, increasing fairness in the world, making the world a fairer place, and making sure the world continues to be a place where people can live, to me, link all of those things together. So for me, and I can take any of those things that you just mentioned, whether it's promoting and helping my minority businesses at Howard University and helping to level that playing field, or develop environmental energy technologies, or helping people, regardless of who they are, in the fire department. And I mean, one of the things I really like about the fire department is that we treat everyone equally, and I wish the world were a little more like that, right? I mean, when we respond to a 911 call, we have no idea if we, well, we find out very fast, but we will, we are as likely to go to, you know, a mansion as to a an apartment or a homeless person on the street or anyone. I mean, 911 is devastatingly equal. I mean, all people get struck with emergencies, and so. And so all of these things that you just mentioned, to me, they're part and parcel of the same mission.
So that has been Darian Unger, a man of many hats, who speaks about both wishing to make the world a more fair place and wishing that through his work he'll be able to perpetuate the existence of humanity on this planet, which is in peril. Due to man-created climate change. So Darian has found that through his myriad activities, he has both on a larger scale level, on an impersonal level, as random as a 911 which becomes very personal, or as an individual level, helping individual students and entrepreneurs, regardless of what he's done, through engineering, through business, through politics, through emergency response, Darian tries to make this world a more fair place and a place that hopefully will be around for subsequent generation. So, Darian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
And this has been episode 107 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Please listen to us at publicinterestpodcast.com or on iTunes, your podcast app on Apple products. And thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.